You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 6, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ian Haney Lopez, professor of law at Berkeley, on his book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Also on the program today, Obamacare looking, federal regulators, state regulators looking to expand doctor networks in the healthcare exchanges. This is how it was supposed to work, folks. You roll it out, and then you fix it on the margins. Also on the program today, EU trade deal. The EU cousin to the TPP looks like it's hit a snag on financial regulation. J.P. Morgan paying more money. Immigration still a problem for Republicans. Massive drought in California. And we will touch on, again, that CBO report that we mentioned yesterday on the program. Many of you missed the program yesterday because we put out only a teaser for freebies. But yesterday we talked extensively about the CBO. What else did we talk about yesterday? The Farm Bill. We talked about Independent Mike, who spent the last 24 hours exchanging emails with, because he's upset. He's upset with me because I don't talk about Benghazi enough.
We also had a lot of listeners from the South who called in to apologize for the Southern Libertarian we had on.
From two days ago. It's quite a call. Yeah, it's been a cavalcade.
And also, I think every day is light bulb day here in some sense.
That's right. Yeah, people were pissed about the light bulbs too. Got this email from listener Axel. Wow, you are so smart. Not. I do not assert myself with either party. I do not think I need the government to be my mama. But I do think Reagan was one of the best. Clinton just rode off, quote, the duck's back, end quote, and swam. I don't know what that means, because I'm not so smart. If you had an ounce of energy to bash the Republicans, you can do the same for Democrats. Both are, and then a series of symbols to imply a swear word. As my father said, quote, in the third world, politicians are hungry for money. In the first world, they are hungry for power. Does DOD Secretary Kerry care about his bank book? No. His wife has all the money in the Caymans. Bash Romney, you did the same. Are you getting a minimum wage of $7? I think not. Give the rest to charity, you hypocrite. When you make the same as the poor, call me. Axel, P.S., piss off. Well, Axel, I want to encourage you to call us into the program at 646-257-3920 later in the program. But first, we will take a break and come back with Professor Ian Haney Lopez on dog whistle politics. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor Ian Haney Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Professor, are you there?
Yes, I sure am. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Thanks for joining us. So, you know, we've talked quite a bit on this program over the years about the sort of about this very aspect and its implication on our politics. What's really interesting to me is, and I've read some of the history of this, but I mean, you really sort of detail sort of the development of these coded racial appeals and tracked it through, really, I guess the past now 50 years it's been. Let's go back before we get to the point of how it affects today's politics, but let's go back to where this really emanated. You write that it starts with George Wallace.
That's right. So it starts with a Southern Democrat who, runs for governor, runs for office trying to be governor of Alabama in 1958. At that point, he's a racial moderate. His opponent is supported by the Klan, and he loses. And Wallace swears, it's a powerful moment. Just before he gives his concession speech, he says in very hard language, "No other son of a bitch is ever going to out-nigger me again." And what he means is, I'm not going to lose on the race issue. And he vows to run as a racial reactionary because it's a way to get elected. But there's a transition. Because of the civil rights movement, you can't use that sort of naked racial epithet anymore. And so very quickly, he segues from the open language of white supremacy to language of states' rights. And now, at the time, everybody understood that states' rights meant the right of southern states to resist integration, that it was a highly racialized term. But at the same time, states' rights gave people a fig leaf of cover, because they could insist that it wasn't race that bothered them, it wasn't integration that bothered them, rather it was this overarching power of the federal government trying to force people to do something. And we can see in even today's politics this sense that the real issue is the federal government is trying to force health care reform, when underlying that is a sense, no, the federal government is taking money from hardworking whites and giving it to undeserving minorities, right? So even this language of an overly powerful federal government continues to have the racial resonance that George Wallace gave to it 50 years ago.
Yeah, and I want to stay on Wallace, because this is really fascinating. I mean, I didn't realize how cynical his racism was. I mean, I think I always had the perspective that Wallace was just simply a racist, and he felt it to his bone. But this was clearly for him an electoral strategy, which was, I was a little bit surprised about it. And I think at one point you quote his biographer as saying that he pioneered what, you know, at that the biographer called a soft porn of racism, which you would call dog whistle racism. But follow, I mean, take us through what happens after Wallace. I mean, you have it. So at that point, it is a Southern Democrat. And how does it sort of, I don't know, how does this shake out to become an electoral strategy for Republicans?
Well, I think that your point about being surprised about his cynicism rather than his sort of hate every black person racism is an incredibly important point. Here's what's important. This is not a story about conservatives who are deeply steeped in anti-black bigotry. Not at all. This is a story about a political party, the Republican Party, that in 1964 consciously makes the decision that they will, as a strategy, use racial division to win white votes. And it's just incredibly important to emphasize this point. Up until 1964, if there was a racist party, it was the Southern Democrats. And the National Democratic Party and the National Republican Party, as a whole, were both similarly, if tepidly, committed to civil rights. But in 1964, or actually starting in 1963, Republicans began to sense that there was some electoral gold to be mined in the growing anxiety around the civil rights movement. And they made the decision that they could win votes if they appealed to this rising level of racial anxiety. Now, it didn't work in 1964 when Barry Goldwater tried it, but it did begin to work in 1968 with Richard Nixon. In 1968, Nixon is running. George Wallace is actually running as an independent. He's running to the right of Nixon, and Nixon worries that he's losing the votes of anxious whites to Wallace, and so late in 1968, Nixon begins to campaign also in favor of states' rights, promising to slow down school integration in the South, and also to sort of pick up on Northern anxiety about school integration, coming out against what he terms forced busing. And forced busing is another one of these dog whistle terms. It pretends as if the issue is putting kids on buses, when really the issue is the school integration that this is promoting. So 1968, you get the Republicans starting to use this dynamic. It's not clear that it's working, but by 1970, some political number crunchers have looked at the numbers, they've looked at dynamics, and by 1970, you get a couple of books that come out, one by Republican consultants, one by Democrats, saying if Republicans use race, they can break apart the New Deal coalition that had joined together Northeastern liberals, the white working class, and blacks. They can break it apart because they can pull white votes from the Democratic constituency. And that's the purposeful strategic playbook that Republicans have been pursuing for the last 50 years.
And that's what I think has been attributed to Jacob Javits, who was a Republican senator from New York. He was the first to talk about that as a Southern strategy. But one thing
exactly.
that there's two things that and I want to just sort of keep it somewhat chronological. Goldwater lost big in 64, but he discovered something about race in relative to the New Deal that I think is very telling about how race will be used in the future. Will you just explain what Goldwater discovered and what the Southern Democratic relationship was to the New Deal and how what Goldwater, you know, Goldwater discovered essentially there's a way to create a cleave.
Yeah, Goldwater is a really important figure because he brings together two core themes. Now, I think most people, when they think about race in the Republican Party, they're only focusing on one of those themes, and that is the use of these coded racial appeals. And they're not focusing on the other core theme, the way in which race has a specific political project for conservatives. So Barry Goldwater was an enemy of the New Deal. He didn't like the way the New Deal provided resources for the middle class, didn't like the way it regulated the economy, didn't like the way it taxed the rich, didn't like the way it tried to break up concentrations of power by corporations. And so he campaigned against all of those things, but those were losing issues in 1964. The New Deal was broadly popular. So Goldwater instead, or in addition, also began to campaign on issues like states' rights using these dog whistle appeals. Now, because the New Deal was so popular, Goldwater lost in a crushing defeat all across the nation except in the five Deep South states. And this was really remarkable because running in the Deep South, he was running as a Republican when for generations people in the Deep South, whites in the Deep South, had been committing to voting for the Democrats. It was also remarkable because the South, more than the North, was committed to the New Deal. The New Deal had done much more to help the South out of the Great Depression than it had the North. But yet we have these diehard Democrats, these tremendous supporters of the New Deal, willing to vote for a Republican antagonist of the New Deal so long as he appealed to them in racial terms. And so Goldwater really sounded this warning. And the warning was, not that the Republicans could win if they used race, but that they could attack and destroy the New Deal by using race. And this is really incredibly important to understand what has happened over the last 50 years. How is it that we as a country have moved from a sense of government on the side of the middle class to where we are now, where government is on the side of the very rich? We did that not because people thought it was a good idea for government to support the very rich, but because people thought they were voting to stop government from helping minorities. It's the racial appeals that has been so destructive to the middle class.
I mean that. I agree. I mean, this can't be emphasized enough. And I think, you know, sort of people forget just how attached to the New Deal the South was, and the idea that they would so quickly lose that attachment, or, you know, I mean, because in Goldwater, you had a pretty stark choice, didn't you? I mean, it wasn't like he was sort of lukewarm on New Deal policies. He was about as hostile as any politician that they had probably, you know, well, certainly that they had voted for up to that point, right? I mean, but this guy was...
Absolutely. I mean, there's a simple example. Much of the South, because it was rural and little industry, because it lagged behind the North, much of the South, when the Great Depression hit in the 1930s, lacked electricity. They lacked electricity. So you're not running water, electricity. The New Deal put in the Tennessee Valley Authority that electrified the rural South. I mean, this was a huge benefit to the South. Barry Goldwater campaigns in 1964 saying that he wants to dismantle the Tennessee Valley Authority. This is crazy. This has only been 20, 30 years, and he's saying, I want to take apart what has lifted you out of terrible poverty and giving you electricity. Now, who would vote for that? Except that Goldwater won majorities among whites in 10 southern states, and he won 5 southern states outright. And this is a very powerful moment, not just for Republicans, but for the conservative wing of the Republican Party, because it said to the conservative wing, our policies have been repudiated across the nation except in the area in which we could most forcefully use a racial appeal. And so what you've had is a process where, over the last 50 years, the conservatives within the Republican Party have been using race to drive the Republican Party further and further to the right. And here I want to pick up a comment you made earlier. You talked about Senator Jacob Javits from New York. He called this the Southern Strategy in order to denounce it. He said, this is the wrong way to go. This is going to destroy society. This is going to be bad for America. And he said that as a moderate Republican. Well, in fact, what you see is that the moderate Republicans have been driven from their party. The party has gone further and further to the right. And the country now suffers today. We suffer levels of wealth inequality we haven't seen in 100 years. We suffer an economic calamity that is most reminiscent of the Great Depression. This has been terribly destructive for the country as a whole.
And we should say that just months or before, maybe weeks before Jacob Javits coins this phrase or at least talks about it and derides it in public, you had Robert Novak. Just tell us what he was reporting just a couple of months before coming out of a meeting of the Republican National Committee in Denver.
Yeah, this is an astounding moment. So Robert Novak, a conservative journalist, attends the 1963 Republican National Convention. And after that convention, he says, you know, a substantial majority of these political, or a substantial number of these Republican leaders, perhaps even a majority, have become convinced that they can win votes by appealing to whites. And he has this really telling quote about how they have become convinced that the Republicans succeed by becoming the white man's party in practice, if not in name. And what that means is that they are going to craft as a purposeful strategy an effort to appeal to whites out of a fear of or anxiety about blacks and other minorities, and that this is going to be their political strategy. And again, I really want to emphasize this. This is not a story about Republicans or Democrats being more or less prejudiced. This is not about bigotry. This is not about prejudice. This is about strategic racism. And what I mean by that is the strategic decision to purposefully use racial anxiety and racial animus to win votes. And so the story of Barry Goldwater, like the story of George Wallace, like the story of Richard Nixon, these are not racial extremists. These are not Klan members. These are people who see that there's an advantage to stirring racial anxiety. And I would say that carries forward to the present. Ronald Reagan really used race baiting, you know, the welfare queen story, attacking welfare, attacking crime on the streets, all of these things. But you see Mitt Romney doing the same thing. He spent half of his advertising budget trying to tie President Obama to welfare. Right? And again, these coded racial terms. Now, when you say that, a lot of conservatives respond by saying, it's outrageous to suggest that Ronald Reagan or Mitt Romney is a bigot. And my rejoinder is, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm not saying they're bigots. I'm saying they made the conscious, strategic decision to stir racial animosity as a way to get elected.
Well, I mean,
and that's a very different claim,
which is basically saying that their voters are bigots. I mean, that's where, I mean, they're looking for votes from bigots. And, you know, it's impossible to know what lies in the heart of Ronald Reagan or Mitt Romney, but they are, I guess, to racists what a gold miner is to gold on some level.
Sam, I'm actually going to disagree with you on that. I don't think that's the way this works. Let's talk about the Tea Party, for example.
Well, wait. I mean, I want to go back to just, let's start with Reagan. Reagan launches his campaign in 1980, or I guess it was in 79, in, well, just outside of Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was famous for only one reason. And that is because three civil rights workers were murdered there. And he talks about state rights, and he talks about essentially stirring up this animosity of the federal government and outsiders coming in to tell people how they should essentially have, function with race relations. He doesn't say race relations, but he doesn't have to finish that part of the sentence, right? I mean, so who is he talking to?
He is talking to whites who are deeply anxious about a changing society, and the changes in that in their society include both changes in race relations, but also changes in the economy, oil crisis, loss of jobs, stagnating economy, and so I really want to push back on the term bigot, because I think we need to be very careful about this. Yes, there is a lot of racial anxiety among whites in a changing society. There's a lot of anxiety also about changing economic position and what's happening to jobs and home prices and health care and food. Right? What's happening, though, is we as a country are moving from, and this is a very good thing, we're moving from ugly sort of open racism to a broad general commitment to racial equality and to a proposition that racism is bad. At the same time, though, culturally, we continue to draw on a lot of ideas that reflect old stereotypes of whites being decent, hardworking, and law-abiding, and minorities being insolent and lazy and criminal. And what's happening with these politicians is these are not open appeals to bigots. That is, the people who are voting for Reagan do not understand themselves as voting for the white man's candidate. Some do, but most don't. Most don't hear an open appeal for their vote on the basis of racial solidarity. Instead, what they hear is more someone who seems to get what they're worried about. And they would absolutely and genuinely reject any sort of claim that they are themselves racist or bigot. And I really want to insist that this is important because it gives us a different window on the Tea Party folks. The populist ones, not the Koch brothers, not Americans for Prosperity. Right. Those are the guys who are stirring race hatred. But the people on the street who are responding, they're worried about their jobs. They're worried about the economy. They're worried about what just happened to their pension, what just happened to their retirement fund. But they also are drawing on these cultural narratives that the biggest threat in their lives are coming from minorities. They are absolutely against racism, and they bristle at any allegation that they might be racist. And they're not in the open, bigoted, hate every minority sense. Nevertheless,
they're undermine their
fear.
They become like a convenient scapegoat. I mean,
exactly.
I guess to a certain extent, you know, this is it's a matter of degree. I mean, on some level, there's a certain semantic quality to this. But it's interesting because there's that famous quote from Lee Atwater, right? When he talks about how whatever it was, 1964, I think he says, we could say nigger, 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 and that would be the way, and I'm quoting Atwater now, that would be the way we get votes. But now it's become more abstract, where we talk about busing, and then it becomes even more abstract where we talk about tax cuts. And to a certain extent, he was in the context of what he was saying was that racism is getting just more abstract. It's almost as if it's like the you can take away the sort of outright you shouldn't allow blacks in a restaurant, but the vestiges of everything else that flowed from that still reside in sort of the lizard brain, as it were.
I think that's right. So what's happening is public racism is evolving so that it always works on two levels. Public racism used to be quite explicit, the nigger sort of comments, and that was a common part of political speech even into the 1950s. But public racism now works on two levels. One level is seemingly neutral. Welfare cheat, food stamp president, affirmative action, all of these terms are on their surface seemingly neutral. But just below the surface, they're appealing to these broad cultural stereotypes. And it's on that level that you get terms like illegal alien, Sharia law in the heartland, Muslims, President Obama is a foreigner. All of these terms are operating as the new sort of public racism. Neutral on one level, triggering racial anxiety on the other. And what happens is this allows conservatives to constantly push racial anxiety into the public consciousness and then also to turn around and deny that they're doing any such thing. Because the minute you press on them, they say, as Newt Gingrich did, yes, I called Obama a food stamp president, but it's just a fact. There are more people on food stamps under Obama than other presidents. It's just a fact. So what he gets to press on that neutrality. But he's a careful wordsmith. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he understands full well, just as Reagan did when he used to decry food stamps, that when you talk about food stamps, implicitly for many whites, you're talking about minorities, and you're talking about lazy minorities who are ripping off the system by getting what they don't deserve. But I think, just to tie this up, this connects to why the Farm Bill cuts $9 billion in food stamps today in 2014.
Right. I mean, and I don't want to get too hung up on this, but I mean, in today's world, okay? Because clearly, you could say in 1950, like, I'm not racist. I don't believe in slavery anymore. There's obviously an evolution in terms of what constitutes racism, but if racism today is not sort of scapegoating black people or brown people for problems that are really a function of something completely different. My economic insecurity is a function of black people or brown people. If that's not racism, if that's not bigotry, what is today? I mean, on one hand, we have these sort of craven politicians who are playing on something residing in, let's face it. I mean, it's playing on something that resides in white people. And I think, you know, it's arguable as to whether or not it is. It's certainly not exclusive to the South. It's more concentrated there. But, you know, Mitt Romney won white people all across the country. But it is. If it's playing on sort of these vestiges, these shadows or remnants of racial stereotypes, I mean, what else would be racism today if not that?
So I think that's a really good point. I would amend it slightly. I would say we need to start talking about racisms. Racism, sort of racial animosity, this is a complex social phenomena. It's going to take many different forms. And so I think we want to preserve an ability to say, listen, there are people out there today who are full white supremacist, Klan, skinhead types. And we want to understand that that's out there. We also want to understand that there's people out there who genuinely believe that they are people of goodwill, but who also subscribe to myths of minority inferiority, minority criminality, minority irresponsibility, right? And that's the sort of cultural racism that many conservative operatives try and take advantage of. here's another racism that I think we need to start to talk about, strategic racism. Strategic racism is not rooted in racial animosity, nor is it rooted in a sort of subscription to cultural ideas. Strategic racism is purposeful, calculating efforts to use racial anxiety in society to one's own benefit. Right. And what I'm saying is the Republican Party at the elite level, Fox News at the elite level, Roger Ailes, Mitt Romney, Lee Atwater, these people are strategic racists. They may or may not have black friends, but they have made the conscious decision to use race, to use racial divisions in society as a way for them to achieve their own agenda.
I couldn't agree more with that assessment. You got guys like Ron Paul who just did it from it's almost like a quasi-political commercial standpoint in using that in his newsletters back in the day that he didn't ever read, that only the guy he hired sent out a bunch of those. And I also think that this is not unrelated to the rise in, you know, ostensibly it is libertarianism, but I get calls from these people all the time where their libertarianism is just a function of the federal government. They don't have a problem with the state government taking away their rights. It's just that they want state powers. They're really neo-Confederates. There has been a rise of that type of politics in the guise of being libertarianism as well, but it's the same old thing. So, I mean, if this is the case, I mean, like, What do we do about this? I mean, if it is the case that what happens next? I mean, how do we get past this? Do we just simply have to wait for a lot of older white people to die off, essentially, or what?
Demography is not going to save us. This is not going to be something that just goes away. I mean, I think that Democrats have been hoping that this would just go away for 50 years. This has been the standard advice, is eventually the bigots will die off. But this isn't just about bigots. This is about these cultural norms, and it's about strategic racists who are constantly reinventing it so that this sort of racial politics is as powerful now as it was in 1970. So, no, we can't wait. What do we need to do? One thing we need to do is we need to understand why these racial narratives are so powerful. And they're powerful because people need a way to understand what's going on in their lives. And they need a sense of who exactly is to blame for the fact that their pensions have been wiped out, that the schools are no good, all of that, right? Some commentator said, resentment abhors a vacuum. And I think that's exactly right. We need to tell people who's at fault. Who's doing this? And that means that liberals need to reclaim a liberal mantle that says not only we need to pull government back on the middle, onto the side of the middle class, but we need to understand that concentrated wealth is working actively to take government over so that it serves them and rigs the game in their favor. So one thing we need to do, we need to tell people who's really at fault for an economy that now showers incredible wealth on the very wealthy, but is really bad for the rest of us. That's one thing. Another thing we need to do is we need to reclaim our commitment to liberal policies that we know work to help the broad middle class. And by middle class, I mean not just the people with $100,000 to $200,000 in income. I mean middle class in that New Deal sense, which included all the working folks who are struggling to rise up out of poverty and enter the middle class. But we need to reinvigorate the concept of a middle class, of government for the middle class, and of liberal policies that help everybody. And the third thing we need to do is we need to be prepared to take head on these claims that government is just for minorities, because that's the claim that meets almost every sort of proposal for liberal reforms. This is just going to be a giveaway for minorities. We need to take it head on, in part through discussions exactly like this, to say, here's the dynamics, here's the rhetoric they use, here's how they're trying to manipulate and bamboozle us, and here's how we can respond by saying, we are not going to be divided by race anymore. We realize that what's good for the whole country is going to be good for everybody, whites and non-whites alike. And that we need to stop being divided by race in a way that ultimately helps the very, very rich.
How, I mean, you know, just based on, and I know we've got to go in a moment, but I mean, just based upon the idea that Goldwater could convince people that even though he harbored such disdain for New Deal policies that literally brought them electricity, that he was talking to people who can remember as being a young child or as a teenager not having electricity in their homes, that really the idea of scapegoating minorities was more powerful than what they could literally, you know, than the idea that they can go on and flick on a switch and have light in their house. How can we, how, you know, if it's possible to do what you're talking about at this stage, what has changed? Is it simply that racism has been muted and become less concentrated and more of an abstraction? Because we are also, frankly, the value of the New Deal has also become more of an abstraction in some ways, and sort of is hindered by, you know, the fact that we don't have people who remember when old people couldn't rely on a retirement.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think one way to understand that something dramatic has changed is that we have an African-American president. Something dramatic has changed in race. And I think the old sort of racism, the incredible fear that many Southern whites had in 1964, that has ameliorated. It is not as powerful, as all-consuming as it once was. And I also think it's important, it's not just that racism has ameliorated somewhat, that it's not quite as potent, but it's also that demographically we're a changing country. And this is a very important point, too. I also think we have had 50 years of the same narrative, that is, that minorities are a threat, and that if you just vote for conservatives, we'll go back to those golden days when, you know, the sort of golden Leave It to Beaver days. 50 years after that narrative, we actually see that what we returned to was the Great Depression. I think the American public, white and non-white, is really hungry for a new narrative about what happened and why and how we can move forward. And I think nothing exemplifies it better than Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. When he promised change, he was really talking about offering a sort of a new way forward that had broad appeal across classes, across age groups, and across races. Now, he abandoned that. Even in his inaugural address, he abandoned that analysis and instead picked up the Republican frame that the problem was big government, and that the solution was tax cuts. And I thought then, I think now, that was insane. He had a moment when he could have told a new narrative to the American people, and it's a narrative that I think people are hungry for. Instead, he reverted to Republican frames, and he ended up getting slammed by it, because then the only narrative that was out there was the story that the government is the enemy because it's by and for minorities. But I think that hunger, that readiness for a new sort of understanding of what has happened to us and why, how we've been misled, how we've been divided by race in a way that only helps the very rich, I think people are hungry for it. And yeah. I think this is not going to be quick. It's not going to be 2014, might not be 2016, but we need to begin to tell this story so that we can understand what happened to us, and so that we can see that the way forward is to reclaim liberalism, but a liberalism that refuses to be divided by race.
Professor Ian Haney-Lopez, the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you. Very enjoyable conversation.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Oops. We're going to take a break. You know, he went to law school. We didn't have a chance to talk to him. He went to law school with President Obama. And I think he also went to high school with President Obama.
Wow.
Yeah. There you have it. Oh, Michael broke his computer. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to head into the fun half. What do we have for you in the fun half? I know we shouldn't spend too much time on how really just cataclysmically stupid Gretchen Carlson is, but sometimes you can't help it. Laura Ingraham, you know, much of what Professor Haney Lopez was talking about is something that we talk about every day on this program. And there is always an example of it. Laura Ingraham gives us probably not even the most recent, because I think she said this yesterday, but the latest example of it. I am not as convinced as the professor is, and maybe it's more of just sort of a certain politeness, but appealing to racial anxieties and the resonance of that appeal, I think, is a function of racism. I don't know, you know, we can slice and dice what racism is, at, you know, strategic racism, subconscious racism.
It seems to me there wouldn't be a market for the type. I think strategic racism is a really smart way of putting it, but there has to be a market for strategic racism.
That's exactly.
And I, that was kind
that's
of
my point with
me.
The gold mine.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You're a gold miner. There's got to be gold. Otherwise, you're just really not doing well. But be that as it may, you know, I mean, I think the point remains. What is really important, you know, and this is why I've said, I'm certainly not the first person to say this, that race is really the central story of American politics. I mean, of American society, I think, since its inception in many respects. That race, when we talk about America, race is still the fundamental driver of our politics. And in some respects, it is fundamental in that it obscures this dynamic that, you know, even guys like that, you know, Thomas Frank wrote a similar book in many respects. What's the matter with Kansas? Maybe not perceiving that much of the social identification is our surrogates for race in some ways, right? I mean, you know, if you perceive the government as simply a way of transferring your wealth to minorities, to immigrants, and you are also simultaneously concerned that you need to have a weapon to fight your government someday, that line's not so far, right? I mean, it is, what you're talking about is when the black people come for me, that's why I need my AK. So let's take a break. We'll head into the funner half of the program. I will do my darndest to get to that Peter Schiff email as well.
It's another story you've been teasing for a while.
Oh, yeah. No, that's my new thing now. I'll, like, tease a story for, like, a week and a half. Folks, many of you...
have you guys heard Justin Bieber's been arrested for driving... I'm just being...
What? Seriously?
No. Are you being...
No. folks, we did a teaser. We're going to do this teaser thing, Teaser Tuesdays, I think. Maybe once a week, maybe twice a month. We're not going to do them on Tuesdays. Well, twice a month, once a week.
Maybe once a week, maybe once every 5 months.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. We can't seem to get the planning down here. But we're going to be doing this Teaser Tuesday. We're not going to do it on Tuesdays necessarily either, because that's
like how the first one yesterday was on a Wednesday.
That's right. But you can't. Teaser Wednesday does not.
Do you enjoy that everybody enjoy Teaser Tuesday on Wednesday?
The number is 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920. You can IM me. Folks, it is your support. Your becoming a member makes it possible for us to do this show on a daily basis. It makes us able to have a show of such quality and will make the show better. Because the less time that I can spend on things like changing the ink in the printer or, well, I'm probably always going to be doing that, but nevertheless, you get the picture. Your support is what keeps the show alive. And as a thank you, we say, here's another 50 minutes a day, which usually these days is working out to be like another 60 minutes or 70 minutes. And when Michael decides that he wants to sort of map out what we talk about in the program, you can skip around to segments that you like. I mean, maybe it might even be worthwhile to put in, like, time codes. Oh, no, Michael's like, no, that would be a terrible idea because that would involve numbers and remembering things. Also, folks, you can support the show by... if you buy Amazon crap, and I know many of you do, if you do it, go to our link at majoritymajoritireportkickback.com. You will find an Amazon link there. Click it, bookmark it, buy your Amazon junk through there. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Tomorrow, Majority Report listeners are going to get a discount on a... local Shakespeare production.
Really?
By one of our listeners. Yeah. We will promote that tomorrow. See, all sorts of goodies. You can IM me at Majority FM. 646-257-3920 is the number. Get the app at majorityapp.com. Give us a review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com/majority. DonateYourAccount.com/majority. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.